Accession number 17747, reel 36.
You were reading your piece about your view of
That's right. Well, there are two or three pieces, but this particular one, I was coming on to... This was actually written on the 13th of July, 44. The general, our divisional general, has issued a memorandum of ideas, and I note a few of these. Dead will be buried in divisional cemeteries is a very heartening message to take back into Italy. Deserters will be sent to labour camps in Burma after the war is concluded in Europe. Now, there's a thought to conjure with. Very inspiring stuff, I've put. The best news is that we must prepare for a campaign of pursuit. This can only mean one thing, that the end of the war is in sight, and that we shall not spend a whole winter again stagnating in vain against a fixed defence line. This is all, of course, provided the Boche can't hold on to his so-called Gothic line until the end of the summer. So much for the strategy. In fact, we did spend the winter in the cold. Everyone would like to see Rome, which has now been retaken, and nearly everyone would like to see the university centres of northern Italy. But we have a deep-seated instinct which tells us that the division will either bypass all these glories or else fly through them with indecent haste. No one is blamed for this. Pleasure and leisure come a very bad second in war. But it is annoying to know that thousands of favoured Americans will be able to visit Rome just because they have a bigger army and correspondingly more frequent periods out of the line. How marvellous it would be to do nominal police duties in Italy after an early armistice. This, of course, is wishful thinking, and in any case, our first wish will be to go home as soon as the war is over. Italy has unpleasant memories for all of us, and the general hope, which the average Englishman on this ship, this must have been written on board ship, would rather die than confess, is that the next campaign will not be so severe or long as the last one. That was written, obviously, on board the ship going back to Italy. But you were talking, or we were talking, about impressions of Egypt, which my daily diaries don't really bring out the flavour of too much, and I don't know whether you could bear with me with a piece I had written in the previous weeks about Egypt. I remember being impressed by the extent of British influence, oblique stroke power, on first sight of Egypt. Names on railway trucks, hoardings, shops, streets themselves, everything were in English as well as Egyptian, and this in a country over which we have no official hold. Egypt has left many strange impressions now that I'm in a cabin on the Staffordshire and have just seen the sun setting over Alexandria. I have arrived in Alex. We sailed back from Alexandria, having sailed into Port Said at the beginning of this stay in Egypt, so that there has been a devious route from Port Said to Alexandria, around the delta. The Suez Canal, the British-style suburbs of Ismailia were the first things we saw. Then the pyramids, the Sphinx, the Nile and the rest have all left their impressions, to say nothing of Cairo with its groppies, shepherds, Madame Bardia's nightclub, the Gezira, the nice colonial Fields Ends, the very good zoo, the British forces' cultural pursuits at a place called Music for All, and so on. I'm grateful for these experiences, but feel angry about Egypt despite this. It is loud, full of hooting cars, fashionable clubs, expensive hotels and cabarets. The English section, now that any possible military danger has gone away, resembles what I would think Singapore was like in peacetime. Everything seems to lack the fine, hard spirit which is now to be found back home in England. Wittingly or otherwise, a great number of base military personnel, base in perhaps more than one sense, are revelling in living conditions better than ever they knew at home, and not unnaturally they resented the intrusion into this Elysium of a fighting division fresh from the line. Most of them probably fought at some time in the desert, but the city life has overtaken and eclipsed them until they have become aptly described as groppy wallahs. Groppy is a name which brings back memories of a garden cafe, hot in the sun, but shaded by immense sunshades and filled with people of every conceivable nationality, all swatting at the persistent flies. The wealthy Egyptians ape the Europeans as much as possible, while retaining the fez as a symbol of their faith, though in many cases money seems to be the primary faith, but otherwise wearing French, British or Greek clothes. Talking of Greeks, it was the revolt of the Greek brigade near Alexandria which caused our first move on April 25th from the re-equipping camp at Cassassine to a strategically important position within sight of the pyramids at Mina. 168 Brigade, sister to our 167 Brigade, did actually deploy against the rebels, who trained British anti-tank guns against British convoys on the Mersa-Matruh coast road at this most vital time in their country's history, a despicable performance. The Egyptians themselves speak plaintively in their wretched Senate about the hardships of war. They are making £250,000 a month out of our division alone, plus heaven knows what in contracts for tents, food, travelling, airports, etc. One stupid senator even went so far as to suggest that they should close the Suez Canal as an international protest when the war is over. I would humbly suggest that they should make some attempt first to put their own house in order. Thousands are dying of malaria in Aswan, but Groppi's ice creams are still very good for the 12,000 or so who are able to afford it. Families of six are living on 2 shillings a day, yet think what excellent fun the Auberge des Pyramides provides for only £1 entry fee. The hypocrisy of this nouveau riche country makes my blood boil, and I deliberately close my eyes to the faults of British imperialism when I see what a hash these people are making of their own country. Last night was the end of our Egyptian stay, and at 5:45 this morning the Staffordshire pulled out to join her convoy for, we suspect, Taranto once again. I was awake at the time, but couldn't rouse sufficient interest or energy to get up and watch. Egypt has left a feeling of apathy within me, and I hope Europe will help me to escape from this. The Delta... gone. Anyway, is it all right if I just finish this little bit to finish off Egypt? Last night was the end of our Egyptian stay, as I've said. The Delta climate, which reached 125 in the shade while we were there, causes all human brains to become dulled and to lack the salt, even the salt of life, even as the sun deprives the body of its salt. It is said that Rommel's men were largely defeated by excessive sunbathing, which made them lax and unresponsive. Certainly a visit to North Africa is necessary to appreciate the full qualities of the men who fought out here for 3 years and won. Yet it's impossible to leave any ancient cultural centre like Egypt without a tinge of regret, arising not from love but from curiosity, unable to be satisfied within the bounds imposed by the army. I would like to have seen the modern university in Cairo and read more about the ancient ruins before visiting them. Without any reading up at all, the pyramids of Giza left an impression of largely mechanical greatness, surrounded by khaki. It was impossible for me to come to grips with that deeper greatness, the reasons for the existence of the pyramids, and the philosophy which enabled the work to be done year in, year out, at the cost of blood and lives, and seemingly all to no purpose. A regrettable feature is the way in which modern Egypt has seized on its ancients to further its present mercenary ends, and a great many Egyptians live by the tourist aspect of the pyramids. In fact, the whole country seems to revel in the dim reflection of its former greatness. It's possible that the old culture, by leaving relics which make present-day life easy for some, has indirectly prevented the emergence of any worthwhile modern culture. Egypt tormented me with its heat and flies, its loudness and squint-eyed, diseased eyes, beggary. It pleased me by the pyramid soothsayer's prophecy that I should be home in December. Above all, it's one of the few countries which could appall me so much as to reconcile me to return to the madness of war in Italy and for this I'm grateful. So you see the amalgam of sentiments about this.
It seems to have been, in some ways, a physically and morally debilitating experience,
yes,
to be in Egypt.
Yes, that's right. We were almost glad and reconciled to going back to the problems of Italy. It was a feeling of decadence. Which I think is not there now. I mean, the place has risen again. The prescient comments about the Suez Canal being annexed and so on. This is all, what, 50 years ago now. When I went to Egypt last year, it's very lively, and of course it's come on enormously. Regrettably, the religious situation has produced other intolerable features. You know, one saw, as a tourist recently, fights breaking out between the more and less fundamentalist people.
In Cairo or in other places?
Well, we went on a trip up the Nile, and you know, the what do you call the Ramadan, when,
yes,
in this incredible heat, they're not allowed to drink anything from sunrise through to sunset, and you get men almost physically baking and getting more and more bad tempered, and little spats break out through sheer I don't know what reaction to the heat. People go slightly mad, as some of our people obviously had done during periods in the desert. So a very odd experience, but one which filled me with admiration for the desert rats and the others who had been in this for years.
And did you get a sense of real tension on your recent visit as a result of these religious developments?
Oh, I think of course Egypt is wholeheartedly Muslim, but it makes you realise the kind of tensions, when you see fundamentalism taking over, it makes you realise the kind of tensions that are going to come. I mean, already, when we went to Cairo from Alexandria, we were escorted by the army and police for most of the way, in case the coach was shot at, and there have been incidents of the cruising boats on the Nile being shot at. This is reflected most directly in a cynical sort of way by the reduction in the price of holidays in Egypt, which are now phenomenally cheap. It's already about half of what we paid a couple of years ago.
Presumably they're in desperate need of the hard currency.
That's right. And the tourists have to be wooed to go into this danger zone, much the same as Americans have to be wooed to come here when there's been an odd bomb. But you can see that in Egypt the tension between the fundamentalists and others is bad enough, but to we have friends in Turkey, and there it is likely to be very much worse, because you have a more westernized approach, a sort of NATO membership, all this kind of thing, running alongside this ferment of growing fundamentalism, which is rather frightening. Sorry, that's a total digression from our war.
But it's an interesting comparison, the change in atmosphere.
Yes.
You seem to have got the impression that now Egypt is much more vigorous and lively as a place, but it's also rather more dangerous.
Yes, I don't know whether this is accurate. I'm not a political commentator, but I mean, in the days we were there, it was not dangerous because it was totally subdued by us. I mean, it isn't every small Middle East country, well, not small, but Middle East country, which has an army of occupation. It does make a huge difference. The rumblings that one could sense then seem to be, I don't know how to put it, but I mean, they at that time King Farouk, who was totally corrupt, was nonetheless a sort of leader, as a symbol of Egypt. And there was some sort of stability there, as well as the stability provided by our occupying troops. When you remove the king and you get colonels vying for power and a much healthier, more democratic situation arising and increasing prosperity, this seems to bring with it greater openings for dissent, as it always does. It'll be very interesting to see what happens, particularly given the sort of joker in the pack, the major joker, which is Israel.
Could also speculate about whether or not what's going on in Algeria might
yes,
spread
indeed.
Through and lead
indeed.
Into...
Indeed, horrendous.
Yes. But you were on the ship.
Yes.
Going back to Italy. Did you know where you were going to land?
Well, we said
there?
We thought we'd...
We thought Taranto.
Taranto. Mm. We didn't know it would either be there or Brindisi,
yes.
presumably. I must find where we are in the... having read those general things about Egypt, I skipped several weeks, probably much to your relief, of Egypt, but which are recording things like the Russians capturing Minsk on the 3rd of July and going to Music for All, hearing Bach's Mass in D minor, and discussing religion and observation of fire course on the Al-Mazar ranges that were obviously gunnery ranges built by the 8th Army out there. I take a shoot in front of a Chinese general, which turns out to be all right, a Chinese general.
Now
that
doing,
I have no idea. But we had Russians. I saw my first Russian officers in Cairo, about 20 of them coming on a mission, a liaison mission, and now Chinese. That I had
presumably
totally
he was a Kuomintang general.
That's right. Oh yes.
Do you remember him saying anything to you?
No.
Doing anything?
No,
really
I didn't. He just observed the shoot. No doubt, doing the usual thing, you know, like inspecting troops when you go as a foreign dignitary. It turns out okay. Dash into Cairo, sudden urge to see Random Harvest, the film Random Harvest, you may remember, at Heliopolis. Bought a suitcase yesterday, all of our kit, all my kit is now packed, very busy. We move off at 2300 and have an appalling wait at Giza Station. Train moves off eventually 4 hours later. Drowse in a so-called Pullman car, the men, unfortunately, in cattle trucks. This was the well-known North African thing of 8 horses or 32 men. The Delta, quite interesting, eventually arrive at Amaria, 80 miles in 13 hours. A pleasant camp, so this was obviously a transit camp on the way back to Alex. In camp, read some of Esther McCracken's gift books to her husband in bed. Now, that's an interesting one. Colonel McCracken had been the colonel I lost when he was shot in the eye and died somewhere near Monte Damiano in December. This was now 6 months later, and I was obviously rummaging through the kit of his, which was not important enough to send back home. And Esther McCracken at that time was the West End's favourite playwright, When We Are Married and various things of that kind. Sorry, that's a digression. And
realizing that, what sort of kit did you send back then? What was considered the essential minimum that had to be returned if an officer was
killed in the field? I think personal papers, you know. Personal papers, his service record book, and anything which was identified as being sensible to send back. I've still got, and it's somewhere in the garage now, I've still got his cutthroat razor, which was not worth sending back, and which I never, of course, used a cutthroat razor, but he always did. He was, I mean, that typifies the man, that he was really a very disciplined Scottish accountant who wouldn't have any truck with newfangled things like safety razors. A man with a steady hand. Yes, we are obviously getting ready to go back, and on our way back to the port. My first trip at last to a place I've always wanted to see is Alexandria, but don't see much of the ancient glory of the place, though there is a handsome seafront. And looking at the sea makes me feel quite homesick, because I was always brought up by the sea in Lincolnshire, and I like the sea. I don't feel happy too far away from it. Break bounds with Jay, the son of a Lincolnshire brewer, and hitch to Alex, stroll around, bump into others who are also broken bounds, including the adjutant.
Which you're supposed to be in the camp.
You're supposed to be in the camp. There. That's right, we just cleared off. Have Gary rides, Gary's being the horse-drawn, covered, what you call them, little carriages.
Yes.
Can't find any classical remains or even a church, but there is a charm which all ports have, and it's hopelessly cosmopolitan. Find a nightclub place. Then an 18-mile night ride from Alex on the top of a crowded 15-ton lorry back to camp. 10th of July, dreadful day, tent walls taken down, so full of blowing sand. Change our money from Egyptian piastres back into BMA. That's British Military Administration, that's right. That is to Military Mediterranean from Egyptian money. Get ready for a voyage. Read a history book, The Years of Endurance, 1792 to 1800, but feel miserable. Spend the fag end of our piastres in the Nafi and get to bed early. Next day, truck at 6:30 to Addicks, taking the regiment in instalments for loading up the ship. Embark on the 10,000-ton Staffordshire, we think, for Taranto. I share a cabin with a huge quartermaster lieutenant. Thank heaven we've left the sand behind. About 2,200 men on board. Too many. Bit of an air raid. Terrific AK-AK fire. Whether it was a panicky response of AK-AK to a real, to a non-existent raid, or a reconnaissance plane sent out by the Germans, I don't know. But they were still just capable of getting an aeroplane across to Egypt.
Did you take your guns with you?
That I wish I could remember, but I think we did, and I think the reason why I conclude this, that we'd had them in fact all the way through, is that, as we shall find in a couple of months' time, two or three of my guns actually blew up, and it was because of excessive wear in the barrels, and I was able to assess that they had fired, I don't know, but a quarter of a million rounds, starting at Salerno and going through. That's the only derivative reason I have for thinking that we probably had the guns with us. But I'm not too sure, and I wouldn't like to swear to it, because it would have made little sense to take our guns, for example, out of the Anzio bridgehead and others to move into our positions.
Yes.
It would have made far more sense for the people who relieved us, whose name I now forget, to have taken over our guns. So, I don't know is the answer.
Would it not have made sense to have issued you with new guns or to have reconditioned them while you were in Egypt?
Indeed, that is the logic, isn't it, that we were there for rest, re-equipping, and it would have made sense. And it may have, for all I know, have happened. I simply haven't recorded it. Whether it would be new guns, I doubt, because I don't think, you know, the need for guns was enormous, and the whole of the Second Front would be taking priority over our little efforts.
But, I mean, you would have materials for repair and...
Oh, yes, there'd be base workshops of a high order, yes. The Remy would be really in business there with major equipment to reline the barrels and all this kind of thing. It could very well have been that that's what happened.
And your own personal kit, I mean, had you been very deficient when you arrived in Egypt and...
Yes, we had, well, I mean, for a start, we had no tropical kit, you see, we had to equip ourselves with that. The officers' shops were very good in Portside and Cairo and Alex. I suppose the cost of the thing was subsidised, but we were able to buy desert boots and bush shirts and light gear. And just generally re-equip ourselves. They had everything.
What about re-equipment before with kit before going back to Italy? Did you get that in Egypt, or was it?
I don't think we
Italy?
Got heavy. You're talking about, you know, heavier clothing, this kind
yes.
of thing. I mean, July in southern Italy isn't all that different from Egypt. I mean, it is still damn hot, although it was a relief to be going to something cooler. But we were still in tropical, you know, desert kit. It was much too hot to be wearing battle dresses. We got off the troop ship and had a walk along the quayside at Alex and did some general reading, put our clocks back 1 hour, read the picture of Dorian Gray, revelled in the good food on board. Ships were always brilliant for food.
It's one way of stopping people becoming really discontented.
I suppose that's right. Also, of course, it reflects the access that ships have to numerous sources of fodder, which more static people don't. Freedom to think is precious with a nice cabin. And war news is excellent, but the return to battle is ominous and a depressing prospect. Collect a marvellous naffy ration and distribute it to troops and others with heaps of English chocolate, cigarettes, etc. The official issue cigarettes are quite dreadful. They're sort of saltpeter from South Africa. Talk with the padre and somebody else. Rather tired of serious reading, skim through novels. Bit of ack-ack fire at sea, but nobody's ill, the sea is calm. The chief danger is at night near Crete. This is what the ack-ack business was about. We have to stand to for an hour on the boat decks, but nothing happens. I don't know how long we were, we can't have been at sea all that long. The dead calm sea and eventually the appearance of the Italian coast. This is after 3 days, that's all. All danger now gone from the air. Excellent smoking concert in the lounge. Food good, climate already cooler. If only this could be a voyage back to England. This is in everyone's mind, and hopes are expressed that the next trip will be just 21 miles. We land at Taranto, 17th of July, close to where we set out. Then there is a most hideous route march, about 8 miles in the heat to a camp. And I got some brownie points from the troops by carrying one of my signallers, 21 radio set. He was obviously exhausted. I took it off him and carried it.
So what was your function at this stage? Did you become signals officer or...?
No, I would be troop leader.
You're a troop leader.
Troop leader, and we were just going in small groups, marching this 8 miles. No, I was not. I wasn't a signals officer. No,
because you had been on effectively on RHQ staff, hadn't you? when you went to Egypt?
Yes, you're quite right. You're absolutely right, and I still was. So I couldn't have been a troop leader of Dong troop, which I later was. Yes. I must have still been in RHQ, and these were RHQ signalers. You're quite right. Mm. Thank you for reminding me. Absolutely right. And we settled in